on ABC Radio.
This is The Big Fish
with Scott Levi.
Good morning. Welcome aboard on this episode of The Big Fish. We catch up with Cherie Forbes and Brett Clark at The Vice this morning, designing flies for brim, bass, whiting and flathead, all of the great accessible bread and butter estuary fish that they target with a long wand, which is great fun and right at our doorstep for most on the coast. Stinker has the ins and outs of breakwall fishing, and Ausfish Unlimited have a new chapter at one of their great inland locations. We'll find out more about that with Renee Ference on The Big Fish. It does take a lot to start a business in this country. And if you're in the fishing business and manufacturing, you've got to be the manufacturing plant, you've got to be the marketing unit, you've got to be the quality control testers. That might be the fun bit for Brett Clark and Cherie Forbes, who manufacture saltwater and freshwater flies, but particularly topwater flies for bass and brim, in their little factory on the central coast of New South Wales. And Brett and Cherie join us on the line. Good morning, guys.
Good morning, Scott.
Good morning, Scott.
I guess at the tying bench, creating these amazing concoctions,
I actually am, to tell you the truth. I'm right here tying right now.
You are working your fingers to the bone. But the fun would have to be the testing, the quality control, the R&D on the water. Do you get enough time for that?
We do. You have to make time for it, I suppose, Scott, you know. So we would always like a little bit more time on the water, but you just have to balance it out, you know. So, yeah, it's a bit of a juggle, but we try our best.
I've had a bit of a go at this, Brett and Cherie, and I can tie a foam fly, you know, and you think you're all creative and you think it looks great. You take it out and it casts like a brick. That balance between effective streamlined casting, where it'll go exactly where you want it to go,
yep,
and fish attractiveness,
yep,
must be a constant quandary that you're faced with.
Yeah, that is the biggest challenge, or one of the biggest challenges, I suppose. It's getting that, you know, as you say, the castability right. So any angler, you know, or any fly angler can pick that tartan up and attach it to their leader and cast it with an element of accuracy, but also have confidence in that fly. So there is a lot of testing, you know, of, you know, different material combinations and so forth to get that, you know, get the castability right, get the profile right when it lands on the water, get the landing right. I've got boxes and bowls and buckets full of stuff that just doesn't work, you know, because it doesn't tick those boxes off. So once you get
are they the ones you give to Cherie, the rejects?
Yeah, they'll end up in my tackle boxes. But I'm okay with that. I can work with that.
He needs a bit of help, doesn't he, Cherie? You usually outfish him.
Yeah, absolutely, that's true. And then from there, you know, once you get the pattern working on the local systems, then it's nice to start sending them out further afield to make sure that they're productive in other waters as well. So it does take a bit of a process. It's just not throwing some gear onto a hook and putting into the marketplace and, you know, and flogging it for some dollars, you know. It's the whole R&D process that goes through, you know, what we do. And, you know, and I suppose when we're tying it, we have an element of confidence, but then you need to put it into other anglers' hands to make sure that it actually works further afield. So that's actually a really important aspect, you know.
Yeah, Cherie, is it really important that they're not just for show, they're for go? Because I've found that things that look great, if you can't get them, we're talking about, you know, accuracy to a millimetre, aren't we? We're talking about actually hitting the log and letting it drop down in front of it to wake some of these hard-pressed fish up. It really makes so much difference. I fish some of the waters that you fish, and if you don't get that fly in there, it doesn't matter if it's the most fantastic, realistic interpretation of a cicada ever made. It just won't elicit a strike.
Yeah, that's right. And I guess, like, there's it can be a bit funny because as selling flies, customers want the fly to look really good, I guess. Like, you know, you can't be testing a fly that looks absolutely horrible and putting it into the marketplace, because people do expect, you know, the fly to look very good quality and a lot of consistency. So I guess there's that balance as well. The fly has to actually look pretty good as well, you know, and work accurately. So
it's like the old lure thing. Half those lures in the fishing tackle shop are to catch the fishermen, not the fish. It's the same with flies, is it?
100%. Yeah, I think so. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
And what about the materials now? I mean, that has been a big change, hasn't it? We were pretty much stuck with deer hair and feathers, but now you've got a lot more in your kit bag to tie. Is that right?
Yeah, I suppose over the last let's say the last decade, there's probably been a rapid acceleration of componentry, you know, for fly building and different synthetic materials and tails and heads and, you know, and that, you know, and all of that sort of synthetic man-made kind of product. But there is a bit of a resurgence with the natural material. So it's a really nice balance, I feel, in the market at the moment. There's still a lot of traditional materials that are being used, and they can actually match really nicely with some of the componentry that's now available to make, you know, even better flies, you know. And I suppose you know, not only the materials, but the hooks have come a long way, you know, in what feels like, you know, a fairly short period of time. So there's, you know, a plethora of models and sizes and cages and capes now, and you can, you know, then build, you know, what you really want to target those species appropriately. So, yeah, you know, I'm in the industry, and it can be overwhelming how much gear is out there. Yeah, but it's good to see.
And is that blending of the modern materials with the ancient materials something that you enjoy?
Yeah, I do. I've tinkered with it a little bit. I tinkered with it a little bit over last season, I tinkered with it over the last couple of seasons. But throughout the last season, I got a nice balance of a really nice foam diver head with some feather on the back of it, mixed with some synthetic flash. And I suppose it was the bringing together of all of those materials that, you know, built the fly that I was really trying to achieve that I couldn't for the previous two or three seasons. So, yeah, it's actually working really, really well.
There's a thousand factors, aren't there? The density, the buoyancy of these materials. I know there's one there that on your Facebook page that looks a hell of a lot like an industrial earplug. you're always looking at materials, I guess, aren't you? Do you go into the haberdashery and they look at you very strangely when you're looking at all the stuff in there?
I always have to agree with me.
It doesn't look so strange then.
It's all... You know, I do a lot of research on materials, to tell you the truth, you know, and whether it's getting, you know, some sample packets in, or, you know, getting, you know, a packet or two or something in to give it a bit of a go. Sometimes they work and sometimes they don't. But then, you know, down the track you find, you know, it's perfect partner that then creates a really nice fly. So sometimes it's just about, you know, waiting for that, you know, for its match to come along for me anyway.
I got a really nice fish the other day on a Sneaky Pete, and I know some of your names are really creative. Who was Pete? Why was he sneaky? You know, and so on and so forth. What are some of the names that you've come up with for some of your original concoctions?
Well, we've got a Cherise Purple Popper.
Yeah, yeah.
Cherise Purple Popper, yeah. That's good alliteration.
I saw some purple popper heads on the wall, so we tied something up and went and tested that. It worked so good, so we created that one.
Cherise Purple Popper. I like the sound of that.
We now have it in Cherise Black Popper, Cherise Olive Popper.
Yeah.
Pretty basic name, but...
Yeah. I don't know. I actually try and keep my names, you know, not too... suppose not too funky, and mainly for myself, you know, so I can remember what they are. But
Like an olive foam diver.
Yeah, olive foam diver. Like a raw prawn has been a really, really good shrimp pattern.
Yeah, how do you fish? I saw some of those online. They just look fantastic. They're really amazing with, you know, different weighted eyes and for different sink rates and all the rest. That was a flat shrimp, I guess a bonefish fly I saw there. You know, what are some of the techniques for fishing shrimp flies?
I suppose it really depends on, I suppose, where you're starting at, you know, the depth of water. So, you know, if we were going to target bream in the local lakes, for instance, where it's about 2.5 metres deep on average, then we would run a 9-foot leader, usually around about 8 pounds at the tippet, and then with a with an intermediate line. So, and then you're looking for your structure. So little rocky outcrops, some weed banks, you know, some patchy weed and sand kind of edging, so that you cast that shrimp fly towards that structure. So if you're going to fish weed edges, for instance, I would cast that fly so that it almost touches that weed edge. And then with the weight of the dumbbells, just allowing it to flutter down the face. And then with your retrieving hand of your fly line, a couple of tiny bumps. And when I say tiny, you might only move that fly line perhaps 10 centimetres. You know, you're really just sort of bumping that fly to make it look like it's a shrimp or a prawn that's popped out of that weed face.
And they dig in too, don't you? If you look at them in those coastal lagoons, there can be really big prawns everywhere, but they dig in and just have their eyes sticking out of the sand. So that might replicate them, you know, going in into the sand to hide as well.
Exactly. So, you know, I suppose where you've got that structure and then you've got the bait there, then, you know, then the predatory fish are going to be there, whether that's, you know, bream or whiting or flathead, you know, if you're in the estuaries, you know, sort of thing. So all of those species, particularly the flathead and the bream, love that flat shrimp or that raw prawn kind of pattern, you know. So
great fun, particularly if you can see them come at it in the clear estuaries. And Cherie, leaders and tippets are, you know, fine and far off. We're talking about very light line.
Yeah, it depends. Like if I put a raw prawn on and I want to fish it for flatties, I'll go like a 16 or 20 pound leader. I typically fish pretty short leaders. I find it a lot easier with my casting to fish a shorter leader. So I've kind of just worked out my own way that I like it. But yeah, if I'm fishing for that sort of bottom fish, I'll fish just a heavier leader for the flatties. And then if I'm fishing brim, I'll put on like a lighter leader that's about 11 pound or 10 pound or sometimes even 8 pound.
Fluorocarbon?
Fluorocarbon.
Yeah.
And I will have a longer leader for the brim.
Yeah, that's a good idea. And obviously, you can't stop the flathead from grabbing it, though. They will bite you off, won't they, if they get the chance, particularly when they get near the kayak and start to saw their head. And you both prefer the kayak fishing. It seems as if on your Facebook it's something that you really love.
Yeah, it is. We love, I guess, like you said, it's the atmosphere of being up the creek as well. So, and we like that casting from that sort of lower profile, that we can get really low and cast underneath the structure, like underneath the overhanging trees. And we like to be able to sort of paddle and position ourselves where we can get a good cast in. You can get a lot of good angles from the kayak. We do. We really like that sort of fishing. But in saying that, we get the boat out and we also enjoy, you know, floating across some sand flats and, you know, putting some really long casts out for some brim on the flats and that sort of thing. So, yeah, but I think when, you know, if you said your favourite, it would have to be getting into the creek in the kayak. Yep.
Well, it was amazing this year, wasn't it, guys? We're speaking with Brett Clark and Cherie Forbes, who tie beautiful flies for bass and brim and flathead and all of those bread and butter species in the estuaries and around the harbours of New South Wales. Kingfish too, they tie flies for some of the bigger sports fish as well. But the fishing up the creeks around our part of the world, guys, has been incredible. You put me onto it. And Cherie, you gave me a great tip. You say, don't go too far up. You know, previously the big bass particularly were, you'd have to paddle a long way up, but they were right down in the freshwater on top of the salt water, right down where the tidal push is. And it really amazed me to be catching bass on and EPs on, you know, surface lures and brim, two big brim. You didn't know what you were going to get. It was a bit of a lottery, wasn't it?
It was so exciting because you weren't just going into the fresh to target bass. You were heading up the creek in the salt, in the brackish, and you had the chance to get brim, bass and estuary perch. So, yeah, it was a bit of a lottery.
Well, actually, you were heading down the creek, weren't you? Like, I went up my usual haunt from the launching place and didn't do too well and thought of what you said to me. So went down a bit to traditionally where it's very salty and banged a beautiful big bass and got towed into a snag and snapped off by, I don't know what it was, maybe a big brim or a big bass or a big EP perhaps. So they were all down. What do you think, Brett, about finally getting some water into our creeks and rivers? What does it say for the next season coming? You know, because we do love that surface stuff. We do love it when the cicadas are drumming in the trees, don't we?
Oh, we certainly do. It's the best way to fish for those species. You know, it's so visual and that sort of thing. But, you know, we've had a bit of a paddle around in some of the local kind of systems around here. And, you know, we experienced all of that water just recently that's pushed pushed down through those creeks. And I suppose what we found is that there's a whole lot, you know, a whole lot of fresh structure that's now, in the water, laying down, about to fall down. Kind of thing. So I think, you know, with the volume of water that we've had, the next bass season is just going to be an absolute cracker, to tell you the truth. I think there'll be a big breeding season that happens, you know, from now on. So, and I think that next season's going to be a real cracker.
What about some of the winter options now as we're getting, it's a great time now, you'd still probably get a few fish on the surface, wouldn't you?
But yeah. I've been sneaking around a little bit. You know, the bite intensity has dropped off enormously, but you still can pick up, you know, the odd fish or two. But I suppose we start to move into looking for different species now as the season changes. So we'll start to go and look along the beaches for some lutterick. We'll head up around that Swansea Lake Mac kind of area and start to look for the salmon. And then do a little bit of winter brimming as well. So there's enough on offer for us to, you know, keep us occupied for the next couple of months, so to speak.
What are some of the tactics for salmon and kingies and those pelagic fish that move in?
Yeah, generally, I suppose we target the salmon a fair bit. We need to travel just a little bit further to be effective on the fly with the king. So we really sort of focus on the salmon, but we do increase our weights a little bit, so we sort of go up to an 8 weight outfit, still with an intermediate line, a leader that runs at around about 16 or 20 pounds, and then we just run our little bait fish profiles, and the common name for them is a surf candy. So I suppose when the salmon come in, they're feeding on that 2.5 to 3 inch sort of size bait fish. And then that's what our flies are replicating. So it's that old saying of matching the hatch, which is a sort of a trout orientated type of saying, but it goes across every species that you're trying to catch on fly. So you really need to match what the fish are focused on eating at that time.
Sometimes everyone catches them. Obviously, salmon aren't that hard to catch, but other times they can be notorious. We've been off Moon Island and there have been schools that extend to Catherine Hill Bay, you know, acres and acres of giant, and they're funny, they get their beautiful duck egg blue back, don't they? You know, they just look so great in the water. And you'll have people bombarding them with lures and trollers, and you'll whiz a fly through them and bang, 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 you're on. And they fight and fight and fight. I first went out with a 6 weight, realised that was a little bit undergunned because I was taking 20 minutes to stop one.
Yeah.
And you just have such fun. And the other people are looking at you, cursing you, saying, bloody fly fishermen, you know, what are they doing that we're not doing? But it's that matching the hatch. You're right, I think.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. What you commonly find is that when the lure guys are throwing, you know, big metals or, you know, big plastics, then they are probably oversized and they don't, you know, that what they're throwing doesn't have that that food source profile, so to speak, and then that's where the fly does have its advantage there, in that you have a, you can generally get closer to the fish if you don't have your big engine running, but you're running your electric, so to speak, so you can get closer to the school, and you can make a more delicate presentation into the school ahead of the pack, so to speak. And then you are putting in, you know, that wider profile that sits right in their face, and that tends to instigate some really good, you know, some really good results.
We were out one time and doing what you were saying, and it actually wasn't working, and it usually works. And then I noticed with the Polaroids on, when I went to lift off and cast back into the school, when I did a water haul, and it was coming through the water at a million miles an hour, all of a sudden they switched onto it.
Yeah.
And it was really weird. So I said, hey, try a extremely rapid retrieve to the point where you're sweeping your rod arm back and ripping the fly through, and bang, they'd hit it. It was bizarre. And that was what switched them on.
Yeah.
So you never know. And then the next day that scares them, and they want that more static, slow retrieve that you're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. That, but that's fishing, isn't it? That's understanding the mood that the fish are in at the time to, you know, to instigate the response. So that's the big part of the puzzle. You know, working out what they're eating is part of it, but then working out how they're going to eat that fly or that presentation is the other part of it. So that's the bit that I actually find really challenging. You know, I know that the fly works, for instance, but then working out what their trigger is to turning the fish from, you know, following or looking into converting them into eating the fly is a really nice challenge to be faced with.
And Cherie, have you ever been tempted to go back to bait or lures, or is it the fly only for you now?
I occasionally use lures. When we fish with Brett's parents, we'll fish for some flatties, and we'll just fish some plastics on spin rods. And I occasionally come home and say, you know, do you want to go for a bait fish on the beach and throw out some pillies? So yeah, I still love all of that. It's really just being down on the water and getting a cast out for anything, really, Scott. So yeah, I'm always into that.
Ah, it's good to hear you, Brett.
I'll drag you along.
He's a bit of a purist.
You can hear the hesitation in my voice. Occasionally, same sort of scenario. But you know, I would always prefer to pick the fly rod up over any other method. You know, that's what I'm challenged with. So
It's so good. It's so addictive. It just is a wonderful, wonderful thing to do. Just casting for me is so cathartic. Just getting it in the right spot. It's a game within a game. You can have a beaut day on the water and not move a fish, or maybe have a couple. But that you know, it's almost a sport in a sport, isn't it? That casting accurately, particularly to snags and bass and brim that are wary, and getting it right in. It just gives you so much fun to do. You know, people shoot targets, they throw quoits, they fire darts, they, you know, hit golf balls towards a little hole. It's a sport without even catching a fish.
Yeah, that's right. We can go up the creek and, you know, we might not catch anything. And we know we've had some really good casts. Like, you can put some casts in and think, wow, how did a fish not come out and, you know, just crunch that fly? But You know, you've had a good cast, and you've got a lot of accurate casts in, and you've hit those back pockets, and you've got it under those trees, and you might not catch anything, but yeah, it does feel good. Just, you know, you're practicing and you're getting it in further, and you're getting more accuracy. So yeah.
Yeah, I'd say bass and brim fishing, if you're a fly angler for freshwater fish like trout, you know, traditional sort of fly species, it'll make you such a better fisher person. Cherie Forbes, Brett Clark, tight lines, keep tying those beautiful flies, and thanks for joining us on The Big Fish.
Thanks, Scott.
Thanks, Scott. Thanks for having us.
Or should I say to you, tight loops?
Exactly, tight loops.
See you.
See you, Cherie. See you, Brett.
See you, Scott.
Lines. come Stinker with his fishing tips. Some hot advice for your fishing trip. Where to find him? What's the bait?
Are you catching any, mate?
Good morning, Stinker.
Hey, g'day, Scott.
Hey, the brim are really on at the moment. I know we've had a few listeners up the Tweed say they're absolutely smashing them. Did you fish around there as a youngster on the seawall or some of those good spots?
Oh, look, that was a fantastic spot. The south wall and the north wall at the entrance to the Tweed River are really magnificent fishing spots. I'm told that the south wall is now difficult to get on, but the north wall, which is the one, closest to Queensland, I suppose, particularly when there's a bit of sea running. Now, there's a bit of a... And there are great sea walls along our coast. Not to be confused with a river breakwall, a sea wall... Those ones that stretch out, fingers out into the sea, and they're pounded by the heavy waves, so they're made of real good solid rocks. But they make magnificent fishing. As they grow older, they get better. But some of the places I've seen, like at Ballina, I know there's a crackers at Iluka. Oh, dear, the Iluka seawall is just fantastic. But a lot of the places along the coast have got seawalls, and there's a certain way I go about it. I don't know what others do, but fishing for brim off a seawall, the first thing you've got to do is find a good, safe rock to sit on, hopefully that's reasonably flat, because you don't want to be fishing like a mountain goat. You want to be fishing on a flat rock, and it must be dry. Don't go trying to fish off a wet rock because it's obviously slippery. Even if the rock thinks that it might get wet when a wave comes over the top of it, get higher up. Now, that makes it sometimes difficult to fish because, remember, if you're up high, you need a long rod to reach out over the rocks. And, of course, the rocks at the base where you've got to pull the fish out are rather gnarly as well, and they've got growth of kunjivoi and barnacles and all those things that really gobble up hooks and sinkers. So it's rather a challenge. So I wouldn't fish with anything less than 20-pound line. I might even go to a trace of 30-pound because it's obviously going to rub on the rocks, and nothing gobbles up more hooks than a kunjivoi. Kunjivoi love hooks. So there you are. You found a nice, safe spot, but in a sea. You don't want it to be flat. I like a sea, so white water. And then, okay, what bait are you going to use? Well, I think the best bait is fresh strip of mullet. You can use cubes of pilchards, or you can even go and use yabbies or prawns. I mean, have a brim will have a crack at just about anything. Brim will have a go at anything at all. But really, something that'll give you more than one nibble is a fillet of mullet, because you're always going to find small fish, butterfish or little nibblers that are going to have a bit of a picnic before the big brim or mangrove jack arrives. Now, the jacks, they hang around the wall up at Tweed Heads, but I don't know how far south they go. Maybe a listener can tell us.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I guess they'll be where you find them, but they'd give you a bit of a surprise, wouldn't they? It'd be hard to get one of those out of that sort of country at your feet.
Oh, yeah, jolly near impossible. You've got to, when the mangrove jack hits, and you've got to assume that every bite that you get is a mangrove jack, because if you don't, you're going to be beaten by the time you wake up to it. So what you do is when you get a good bite, you go whack, and then you wind like crazy. You don't give anything at all. Don't let them have any line at all, none, absolutely zilch. So you just bend your back and bow your rod and pull so that your line's like a violin string, and with any luck at all, and that's what it all boils down to, luck, you might be able to get it out of the water and up the side of the seawall. But 9 times out of 10, as soon as a jack takes your bait, in those conditions, he'll head straight for the nearest rocky ledge and you won't get him out.
Hey, if my memory serves me right, a relative of yours engineered some of the seawalls on the far north coast.
Well, that was my grandfather, John Hutton. He did. He did the, see, at Tweed, there's an old south wall and a new south wall. The old south walls are much shorter. And on the northern side of the Tweed River is the old south wall and the new south wall. Now, the old south wall doesn't go out all that far, but the old south wall and all the training walls inside the river, as is the same at Coffs Harbour, at Yamba and Iluka, my grandfather was in charge of Public Works, and that was his job, to build training walls along the far north coast.
I tell you what, if you had been part of that, you would have made sure he put a few flat rocks in that you could balance your bucket on and fish from.
Now, and I tell you what, you know, that when I go up there, that crosses my mind. I thought, if I knew him then, I would have said, listen, mate, you know, any chance of putting one square on it, you know? But then, of course, you've got to be first there, because you can bet your bottom dollar that someone else is going to beat you there.
Oh, dear. Hey, on to other good things. We're speaking with John Stinker Clark around the port of Port Stephens and all of our Bute estuaries up and down the coast. It's been a bit of a interrupted crabbing season, particularly because of the water being full of so much fresh. Are they still around? Is it still worth, if you're allowed to put a pot out, obviously the ones that don't kill the turtles, or if you can catch them on hand line and baited lines, is it worth having a crack still?
Always. It's always worth having a crab trap in the water. So in Port Stephens, you can have two crab traps and four set nets, lift dilly pots or lift nets. You can't have any witches' hats at all. It's against the law.
And your traps have to have a certain aperture too, don't they?
That's right. That's right. 36 centimetres. They've got to be an entrance of less than 36 centimetres. Now, that law has been in place for 6 years. Only 6 years, and it differs from everywhere else in New South Wales. Now, that law was put in place because we have a very high population of beautiful sea turtles, and it has been a fantastic law. Oh, gee, you know, some things you make a new law and you don't know whether it's worked or not, but I can tell you now that it has worked, because there's no reported turtle drownings to me in those 6 years, and the catch of crabs, both mud crabs and blue swimmers, have been excellent, absolutely excellent. So there's not one grumpy crabber in Port Stephens. Isn't that good? Not one grumpy crabber.
I think it's exciting pulling up the dilly pot too, and it's so much easier to get the damn things out. I mean, the fact that they get so tangled in that really light mesh in the witches' hats, and you're just constantly mucking around, and of course the mud crabs just go straight through them. They were a pain, weren't they? But the dilly pot with its heavy mesh that can't catch a turtle, and you've got to bring it up, and they're sitting in there, if they're not size or if they're buried female, over the side real quick. It's a lot easier, I reckon.
It certainly is. But it's Port Stephens is made for crabbing. I mean, it's a home for flathead. It's a home for mulloway. And brim go crackers, but because of all the oysters, of course, they're the main ones, and the whiting then sneak into the system. We've had long-tails visitors over the last month or so. I mean, it really is a fishing haven, but the crabbing always fascinates me. So, yes, you can have a trap out, you know, any time of the year, pretty much. Pretty much any time of the year. Sometimes you'll do better than others, of course, but probably the most successful spots would be Karua, the Karua River. Our Lemon Tree Passage is another red hot spot, Tanilba Bay. Back off Soldiers Point, back in the back half of the port, you're more likely to catch, it's more consistent in the back half of the port, but not to say that you can't get beautiful, beautiful blue swimmers in the front half of the port. That's around Corlett to Shoal Bay. So anyone who knows that area will work the crab traps pretty much 12 months of the year.
That's interesting, isn't it? What about when you get a blue swimmer and a cranky mud crab in the same trap? Do they? I think the blue swimmers had come off second best, wouldn't they?
Oh, yeah. You would never back a blue swimmer against a... You wouldn't back much against a mud crab. A mud crab, inside a crab trap, the mud crab, he's the king. There's no doubt about that. And cranky. The only thing that probably might settle him down a little bit, have you ever caught a nummy ray in a trap? A nummy
no,
ray?
No, I haven't. I hear they give you a bit of a shock.
Oh, that's an understatement. But they're the weirdest creature I've ever seen around the joint. They're sort of like a stingray with their tail cut off, and they've got a mean look on their face, and they generate electricity. Now, don't ask me how. It's got me beat. But I know for one thing for sure, that if you put your finger on that fish, it's a fish, you'll get a zap. Now, how he does that on blood, he doesn't know there's no battery. He hasn't got a battery inserted. So how does it happen? I don't know. I mean, an old bloke told me, and, you know, you've got to be careful with what old bloke tells you, especially when they wink at you. And they say that, one, if you put your finger on it or put your foot on one of those things and you put a light globe in your mouth, the light globe will go on. And I said, you want to give it a try next time? I said, oh, yeah, right, I'll take your word for that.
Was his name Fester Adams from the Adams family?
Yes, well, Fester. See, Fester must have trodden on one of those nummy rays because he could do it, but he's the only bloke I ever knew who could.
I remember watching him on the telly when I was a kid. We're talking to Stinker about crabbing and brimming and all the good things you can do at this time of year. Is Port Stephens, you think, I know you get them in the Hawkesbury and further down the south coast, the muddies, but is it the real crossover zone for things like tropical species like mangrove jacks? And traditionally mud crabs are seen as a Queensland thing too, aren't they?
Yes, I feel as though there's a very slow movement south from those tropical fish. They're not coming in big numbers, but I mean, I think a real good test fish to find out whether the waters are getting warm is the mangrove jack. Now, I know you get them in Coffs Harbour. I know they get mangrove jacks, but I don't know how much further you can regularly catch a mangrove jack. I would really like to know. But in all the years, the nearly 40 years that I've been reporting fishing in Port Stephens, I've only reported three caught on a line, two or three speared, and another two or three in nets. So that's not very many.
Pretty gnarly, but it'd be interesting to hear from our listeners how far they go down the coast. Can they send you an email to Stinker?
Yes. Look, I'm always really interested to hear what our listeners have got to say about anything that's mentioned on this program, because I'm always keen. You know, you spend your lifetime fishing, but, gee, there's still a hell of a lot to learn, Scott, isn't there? So anyone who want to contact me, it's stinkerfishing@yahoo.com. And please, any questions or any answers to my questions, I'm only too happy to hear from you any time.
All right, Stinker.
And I respond to all correspondents.
Thanks for coming to us live from the boat. I know you've got to head out and pull your crab pot, so hopefully there's one there with your name on it. Well, it does have your name on it because it's your pot.
That's right.
And hopefully the motor starts first pull.
It's always a beautiful sound, that.
It is.
When your motor starts, it's a beautiful sound.
It is. And you just feel so good. And when you hear someone labouring with that pull and it coughs and splutters and doesn't go, you feel so sorry for the poor people, don't you?
Well, no, I don't know whether I do.
But I do pride myself in the little five horse, and I give her a bit of choke, give her one pull with the choke on, put the choke back in, and give it a pull, and she fires, roars with the power of all those. It's a lovely feeling.
It is.
Hey, tight lines, mate. Thanks for joining us again.
Hooray, Scott.
On ABC Radio, it's The Big Fish with Scott Levi.
Renee Ference is the Director of Engagement and Culture at Ausfish Unlimited, the people who look after fish habitat and save fish habitat and create fish habitat and do all sorts of other things as well when it comes to this wonderful recreational pastime of fishing. Good morning, Renee.
Good morning, Scott. How are you?
Going really well. You've got some big news. You've just christened another chapter.
Yes, it feels like that, doesn't it? They do take a long time to get up and running, but we've just announced the Goondiwindi chapter, so I'm really pleased that that one's come up. And this, we've got a really passionate group of wreck fishers out there that are really wanting to get their hands dirty.
What are they doing? I believe there's a big cod fishing event that's now going to benefit habitat restoration programs.
Yeah, so a lot of the chapters come to us and say, how can we get involved? What can we do here? And that process does tend to take a little while. We need to get some of our habitat experts out there to start looking at what's going on out in their local waterway. Up there, it's the McIntyre River system and what they might need in terms of habitat restoration. So a lot of the times when a new chapter in Ausfish gets started, they look at fundraising. So these guys have got a Cod Classic coming up. So if you are free, the Cod Classic is happening on the 11th and to the 13th of June. And it's all going to their Ausfish chapter to help them with what those projects might be and look like in the future.
So are these restoration projects, for example, re-snagging or riverbank planting that we've spoken to Anne Michie about on the program, cleanups, education, restocking, all these things that they do, are they driven by the local chapters?
They are. That's how we work. We work from the ground up. We get those wreck fishers to come and say to us, we love fishing and we want to see it here and we want to see it better because we know we used to fish, 20 years ago and get heaps of fish and we are seeing that there's not much happening, or we might need to see that there's, you know, a waterway that needs to be repaired or a place on the bank that needs more of their riparian zone fixed. And quite often some of them don't know where to start. So they come to us and say, how do we get involved? How do we set up and how do we do Ausfish? People say, how do we do Ausfish? So, so it is built from the ground up. We get the wreck fishers to tell us what they want to fix, and we get the habitat experts, the scientists, to come and say, this is how we're going to do it. And then those wreck fishers are the ones rolling up their sleeve and planting the trees or working out where the snags are going to be, habitat mapping that area of the river that might need to be re-snagged. So those wreck fishers do get out on their kites and boats and do that science part, that citizen science part of that work first. So absolutely,
that's fun. Do they ever toss a lure during?
Of course they do. Of course.
I'm out doing research. Serious stuff here. Oh, I got a bite.
No, we get that all the time. We get photos of people saying just habitat mapping and the lines out. But absolutely, I mean, that's part of the joy as well.
I reckon some of the country folk, like Harry and the mob at Goondiwindi, would say, hop in the boat, we'll take you down the river.
They do. It's such a, I mean, fishing is social anyway, isn't it? But I think
there's a lot more to it than catching fish. Yeah.
Yeah, isn't it? But I think there is this sense of when you're an Ausfish, people wear their hats and they, you know, we've got people saying, can I have a shirt? And I want to wear it with pride and meet other people. So absolutely, you know, once you join, you meet new people and you meet new people doing this kind of work across the country. And whether that's in WA or New South Wales or up north or down south, you'll meet people that are interested in similar things. And that's what makes Ausfish so different as well. A lot of the people that have joined Ausfish, they've been fishing for years and they have so much experience, and I'm still learning from some of them, Scott. So, yeah, you do get to really share that. And then you get to learn about habitat, and actually learning about habitat helps your fishing as well.
Ausfish.org.au, it's a not-for-profit community of fisher folk, women and men, who are trying to make fishing better for the future, and we can do it. We can bring back our inland rivers to their former glory if we work hard. Or give them a call, 1-800-431-308. You might want to form your own chapter and fix your local river. Renee Ferenc, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Scott. Lovely to hear from you.
Renee from Ausfish is the Director of Engagement and Culture.
On ABC Radio, it's The Big Fish with Scott Levi.
Peter LeBlanc has a pretty good office. It takes in Broken Bay pit water, which is just a gorgeous part of the world. And up the Hawkesbury, there's always a fish or two to be had. And it's very accessible and close for millions of fishos in the Sydney Basin. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, Scotty. How are you?
I'm going really well. What's on the chew?
Oh, mate, we've got some tailor about in Broken Bay. We've got the odd kingie still in pit water. There's flounder to be caught. We've also got some squid up and down along the bays and what have you in pit water as well. So there's plenty of things, you know, to keep people amused. And, of course, you've still got your brim and the usual bread and butter species there as well.
There's a bit of a conundrum when you're fishing with Pete LeBlanc. If you're getting the big squid, you think, that is going to be so nice in the frying pan. Should I cut it up or should I put it on live for a kingfish? It does always have me in two minds.
Well, there's another one that's chucked into the mix now too, mate. There's been some decent jewies been getting caught around Flint and Steel as well. So you've got to think whether you're going to use it for them now as well.
They love the fresh squid, don't they? They smell the difference. I know that. And so do the kings.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, when you've got a nice big squid head out there and it's just wafting down the Burley Trail, you know, it's quite a deadly bait for those jewfish. There's not many of them that can say no.
But there's no doubt they know the difference between the fresh local and something that came out of the freezer box at the service station.
They'd obviously know the difference. They're in the business of eating them all the time, so yeah. It'd be a bit like us, I think.
We know the good
eating off prawns or fresh prawns.
Exactly right. That's a very good point you make. I think you've come up with the perfect compromise there. The big inky head with the beak, which is the only inedible bit, or the feathers, no good either, and then keep the tube for calamari rings. So the jewfish are happy and you're happy.
Yeah, exactly right. And like you said, you know, be able to let it down there, you know, along the Burley Trail. There's not only just them that'll eat it. Of course, you've got many other species, but of course, that's the targeted one.
Is there still nothing more exciting to you? I know a really big king coming to the boat, but I think a really big jewfish coming to the boat out of the Hawkesbury, materialising up out of that murky water, is still probably the most exciting thing you'll ever see.
Oh, one of them, mate, definitely. Like you said, it's one of those ones that takes your breath away, especially when you start getting them the metre and over the metre. They're a very, very good-looking fish, and you've got to pinch yourself, you know, how lucky you are to be able to go and target one of those species so close to Sydney.
Yeah, it is quite an extraordinary thing, and you get them up George's River and up in Sydney Harbour as well, but the Hawkesbury is the place. It's the place where it's renowned to catch a big jewfish. And the big wet, I mean, the big floods that we've had, did it wash them down from upriver, or are they out in Broken Bay chasing the tailor? Because they tend to love the tailor too, don't they?
They do. When we've been out there with the tailor, you know, as soon as we get a decent one that's of right length, legal size, you know, we've been stripping him up and we've been chucking down a fillet to have down on the dragging him on the bottom while we're still casting lures and what have you to all the melee that's on the surface. So, look, we haven't caught any around the actual schools, but I'm sure that there's going to be a few of them around. They've been out there for, you know, a couple of weeks now, the jewies, so they'll be moving around quite a bit now.
Sounds like worth targeting. I mean, they're just such great fish. What about Flint and Steel and those other famous spots at the mouth of the Hawkesbury and in Broken Bay? I mean, sometimes it's you need to take a ticket to get your parking spot. Is it busy?
It is busy at the moment, but as we all know, with that area there, they only once fished it. The best time is the change of the tide. So you get there an hour and a half before the change of the tide, then you fish through the change of the tide, reset your anchor, and then you go and fish the next hour again. And so that gets, you know, 2.5 hours worth of fishing in that area. The big thing is, like you said, it is a lot of people that get there, but if it starts getting too packed, you've still got Juneau Point, there's still Walker's Point, Eleanor's Bluff, you've still got the pressure wave that's between Eleanor's Bluff and Juneau Point.
A shoreline along Little Wobby there that you often go to, and I'll tell the listeners something, and this is not a lie, every time Pete and I have been out to target a jewy, we've actually got one, which is quite scary because they're supposed to be hard, but I think you know what you're talking about. Tight lines, Pete LeBlanc, we'll catch you next time on The Big Fish.
I look forward to it, Scott. Thanks for the call.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.